Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcaster.
Welcome back to the program. My name is Kerry Stevenson, and I have to tell you, pretty excited today, and you guys, I want you to sit up and take some notice, because today I am delighted to welcome Rick Rawl. He is the CEO and president of Sprott US Holdings. Now, Rick and I have known each other for some time, because back in 2011, he took the long road and came out to Australia to our Gold Precious Metals Conference, and it was held at Luna Park. We are in a little bit of a loony bin at the moment. Rick's been in the securities business since 1974. He has a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of experience. I'm delighted that he's joining me today. Rick, great to see you again.
Kerry, I'm delighted to see you. I'm delighted, too, not to have to walk through the clown's mouth to get in to give my lecture. I was always wondering if that was intentional on your part.
It was a lot of fun, but it was interesting in those days, wasn't it, Rick? Because we had a lot of people. It was 2011. The gold price was very strong. We had close to 1,000 people there. There was a lot of talk about gold increasing at that time. And now we've been through quite a bit of a long bearish market. And right now it seems everyone's talking about gold and precious metals. So most recently, you're based over there in the US, Canada area. Jerome Powell gave his speech. I'd like your views on what he said in terms of inflation and how that might impact the sector.
I listen to government officials mostly for amusement, Kerry.
I think you said, actually, Rick, you said, I don't see a cure for government.
That's correct. When somebody was asking me about the impact of the COVID cure and that impact on gold, I said, well, they'll find a cure for COVID, but gold moves because of government, and they won't find a cure for government. It's a far worse pandemic, in my belief, than COVID. But anyway, I editorialize. I think the Fed chair, I think all of the officials, Powell and all of them, are sort of constrained in terms of what they can say. They have some goals. I think they're desperately trying to keep the economy afloat with liquidity. And we'll talk later about the nature of that liquidity. I think, too, that they're desperately trying to maintain confidence in the US dollar. Maintain confidence in the dollar at the same time that they're working mightily day and night debasing it.
Yeah.
The idea that Powell might tell the truth seems very odd. He's constrained. He's unable by his very job to tell the truth. And actually, I think while the markets pay attention to these big thinkers on a very short-term basis, I don't think Powell or Trump or any of the rest of these people have very much of a long-term influence, for reasons that we'll discuss. So I watch them for amusement, but I don't take much home. If I really paid attention to them, I'd probably get angry. And being angry, being emotional, is dangerous in an investor.
When you say you don't pay much attention to them, they do have an influence on the market, though, Rick. And I think that although we may not like what they say, don't they influence, as you said before, obviously, liquidity. There's a lot of money. Governments are just printing what I call funny money into the market to create liquidity, and the confidence in the US dollar. It is a psychological game.
If I thought he was going to do what he said he was going to do, I might listen. Right. But he's very constrained as to what he might do. He can say whatever he wants to, but whatever he wants to say doesn't undo $850 billion dollars in deficits in the month of July alone. What they say is one thing. What they do is a very different thing. And what they do in the context of our discussion, I think, is very, very bad for the economy and mankind, and very, very good for gold.
When you say it's bad for mankind and good for gold, if you could just extrapolate a little bit on that. You're talking about, I guess, the printing of fiat currency and debasing the US dollar and other currencies around the world.
Yes, briefly, The nature of what's happening in the political context is a war on producers, a war on savers by spenders. Mm. In democracy, that's a natural war because spenders are more numerous than savers. There's a wonderful libertarian phrase up here in the States that goes, an election is the way that four coyotes and a lamb vote on the lunch menu. Coyote might be your dingo. The savers, of course, being the lamb and the spenders being the coyotes. So the broad thesis that you have to think about is the political process, which is the mechanism by which some of the productive assets of society are stolen and distributed to other people. Mencken famously said, elections are advanced auctions of stolen property. Wow. And the saying is all about the ongoing war against producers and savers by spenders. And when I talk about the actions of the government and the Fed as being deleterious to mankind, I think there are several pernicious aspects to it. One is that billions of people around the world have come to believe the government actually can and will help them rather than being reliant on themselves, which I think is fraud. And I think fraud is bad for mankind. I also think that encouraging people not to save, but rather to consume, not to invest, but rather to speculate, is bad. And I believe that the debasement of the currency and the debasement of people's private savings via quantitative easing, via debt and deficits, via negative interest rates are horrific. I mean, I really truly believe that they're a crime. What I believe doesn't matter much. But when you say, how are these actions deleterious to mankind, I would suggest that debasing the medium of exchange and devaluing people's savings is a bad thing, not a good thing. And I don't think it will play out well in the economy. I don't think it'll play out well in the political arena, but I do think it'll play out well for gold.
Rick, you mentioned just then speculation, and there's two things I'd like to unpack here. what we're seeing, I think, at the moment is a lot of people that don't have knowledge but are hearing that the stock market is on a tear and it keeps going up, and it's almost like it's abandoned all sense of reality of the fact that we are in economic challenging times. And I am concerned about people throwing money into the stock market just because it's going up, excuse me, and treating it like a casino. Do you see that over in the US? Is it the same over there as well? And what is your advice to people right now? Because you speak about savings, that's not the way to go, that people do need to invest, but most people don't even understand the first thing.
I was doing a conference like this a few days ago for a generalist audience, a young audience. I enjoy talking to millennial investors. And I described how what shares were really fractional ownership in a business. Mm. And that everybody was concerned about the price information, what the share was selling for. But I discussed with the audience that price information had no use if you didn't have an opinion as to the value of the business. If you own 1/100 millionth of the business, what's the business worth? And how does that vary from the share price? And I think fully half of the audience thought that that was a new concept. To them, a share was a sort of a floating abstraction, something that you buy and sell based on factors that were somehow mysterious to them. That isn't even speculation. It's in fact gambling.
Yes.
And I think a couple things have happened. I think we've had extraordinarily generous debt and equity markets around the world, really starting in 1982. So we've been spoiled against a backdrop of a market that bailed us out of our own idiocy. A second thing that's happened, I think, Carrie, is that artificially low interest rates, which is to say negative interest rates, means that people are penalized for being prudent. People that put their money in conventional safe savings products understand that they're losing 1.5 to 2% in purchasing power a year. And they need, in their own mind, to do better. And the consequence of needing to do better means that they take risks that they don't understand. many people have come to regard equities, because they've performed for 30 years, as savings.
Yeah.
I came into the business in the early 70s. And if you came in the business when I did, you came into an equities market that began to decline in 1968 and continued to decline until 1982. A 14-year bear market that scraped a little tiny bit off people's net worth every month. So obviously, my understanding of what equity markets are all about is different than some other people that haven't been involved in the game as long as I have. I would urge all of your listeners, every single one of them, to either buy or check out a book from the library called The Intelligent Investor by Ben Graham. And then after you've checked it out, read it.
Yeah.
Relative to the effort required to read it, it's the best investing book of all times. And if you read it and if you follow the lessons in that book, you will succeed as an investor. You simply will succeed as an investor. It's difficult to do, but it's more than prudent these days. It's necessary to do it.
But I think, Rick, we live in an age, you know, we have social media, which is fast and furious, and people's attention spans are that of a gnat, and they want instant gratification. And so right now, the market, the equity markets, and obviously the gold price, although had a little bit of a pullback, everybody's talking about it at the moment. Do you believe that people are going to have, I guess, the necessary wherewithal to really study and do that? Or do you think the gambling, as you said before, rather than speculation, is just going to continue and it will get ugly? Because my feeling right now is that potentially there could be another pullback like there was in March. And it's the psychology of investing. People will lose money. People get hurt.
Carrie, the world is too big for me to save. I'm talking to your listeners and my clients. If there's a bloodbath and participation is optional, I would prefer the no option. and I don't think that there's any requirement, just because the world is going crazy, that you need to join the world. And I certainly don't. I certainly don't intend to do that. And I'm not enough of an economist or a market scholar to say for certain that there is going to be a liquidity panic of the type that you describe. I personally believe it's more likely than not, but I actually don't let my beliefs drive my actions as much as I let the fundamentals associated with each individual investment decision drive my actions. My experience has been that the entire equity market can go like a boulder off a bridge, but high quality businesses either don't go off the bridge or they recover more quickly. The last couple of liquidity crises, I guess as a consequence of my age and the fact that I've been in the markets for a long time, turned out to be wonderful opportunities for me. I had a lot of liquidity, as I do now. And having liquidity, despite the fact that I lose purchasing power with that liquidity, gives me both the cash and the courage to take advantage of volatility as opposed to being taken advantage of. Being stupid is optional. The people listening to this discussion do not have to be dumb. It's easier to be dumb. And by the way, I'm not criticizing social media. I think the democratization of information is good. But I think that you need to develop your own paradigm and filter for that information. And that's why I believe that people should read The Intelligent Investor. Then you can take all of the information that's instantaneously available for you and pass it through a filter and determine what for you is usable and what isn't.
That is fantastic advice. And I, for one, I've heard about it. I haven't read it, but I will take your advice on The Intelligent Investor, because I love books. And I always encourage people that listen to some of my talks that, you know, not only to hedge and diversify, but read. Stop watching mainstream media. That's what's going to give you great education. Rick, let's go into something that you and I both comment on, and that is precious metals and gold. Right now, a lot of talk about the precious metals market. It's the gold price and the silver price have gathered a pace a little bit of a pullback. What are your views short and long term on precious metals?
Carrie, the wind is in precious metal sails first of all. It doesn't mean that there can't be a 15 or 20% cyclical decline in the secular bull market. There will be. If you are grounded in the fundamentals, you'll survive that pullback. If you aren't, you'll get shaken out and you'll miss the move. There's four things that I want your listeners to understand about this market in gold. And I should say maybe five things. In 45 years, I've been through two prior gold bull markets, the 1970 to 81 market, the 2000 to 2008 or 2011, depending on how you characterize it, bull market. And I've been through eight cyclical recoveries from oversold bottoms, sometimes occurring in bull markets, sometimes occurring in bear markets. Gold is cyclical, and deeply volatile. And you need to understand that at the beginning of the conversation. That's the anatomy of the market. Now let's look at the fundamentals. Gold moves for many reasons, but primarily fear. And a specific kind of fear, not fear of nuclear war, not fear of COVID, but rather fear of the depreciation of the purchasing power of people's savings. Particularly, I think, maybe it's American-centric, but particularly fear of savings denominated in the world's reserve currency. For the last 30 years, when something went wrong other places, people just bought U.S. treasuries. The U.S. treasury was the safe haven. Gold wasn't. But now people have reason to be afraid of the safe haven, too. And let's go over them. The first is quantitative easing. If you did it yourself, Carrie, it would be called counterfeiting.
Yeah.
And you would be put in prison. If your government does it, it's called policy. It's popular, and they're reelected. And we are quantitatively easing, which is to say counterfeiting U.S. dollars, specious. They're not even pieces of paper anymore. They're keystrokes, as fast as we possibly can. Make no mistake, the voters are demanding liquidity. And as H.L. Mencken said, the voters usually get what they want, often good and hard. And that's what's going to happen in this circumstance. You can't help but debase the currency when you counterfeit it. The second sin is debt and deficits. I don't know the Australian circumstance. I'm sure it's not pretty. But in the United States, the on-balance sheet liabilities of the federal government exceed $24 trillion. The off-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. government, that isn't to say liabilities to bondholders, but rather liabilities to old folks like me and other people, entitlements, exceed $100 trillion.
Wow.
So the keeper of the U.S. currency, the U.S. government, is $120 trillion upside down. How do we service this debt? Well, the national income, which is to say taxes and fees minus expenses. The problem is that that number is negative two. We run deficits, not surpluses. And it's impossible to add a column of negative numbers, which is to say deficits, and arrive at a positive sum, particularly a positive sum necessary to amortize $120 trillion in obligations. It cannot be done. The debt will be rolled, as Buffett said, not paid. And the debt can't even be serviced without artificially low interest rates. So let's move on to interest rates. By the way, just to heap a little more misery on the last point, in the month of July, in 1 month, the U.S. federal deficit was $850 billion. That doesn't include state and local deficits, nor does it include unfunded pension liabilities.
Just for July?
Just for July. Artificially low interest rates, negative real interest rates. Interest rates are the payment that savers get for forestalling consumption rather than consuming now, consuming 5 years ago, and lending the principal to people who need or want to consume now. It's the compensation, and people are less inclined to that compensation if it's negative, of course. Mm. Interest rates are also the risk premium that you are paid to trust the person who is borrowing your money. As Warren Buffett says, negative real interest rates are not a force of nature. they're a construct of government. In this case, the root word of construct, of course, being con. My friend Jim Grant goes so far as to call negative interest rates, quote, return-free risk. And I would argue with you, or probably not with you, but with others, that the main competition for gold for the last 30 years has been the U.S. 10-year treasury. world's benchmark security. And the U.S. 10-year Treasury pays you 55 basis points in a currency that the Congressional Budget Office says is depreciating by 1.6% a year. In other words, the U.S. government, for the first time in history, is telling you the truth. If you give them money, they will give you back less in 10 years. So gold is competing with return-free risk. So there are three pieces of wind in gold sales. Again, counterfeiting, calling it what it is. Debt and deficits and negative real interest rates. But there's a fourth thing that you need to consider too, Carrie. Gold is under-owned, way under-owned, even. I read a study about 18 months ago that suggests that the market share of precious metals and precious metals related equities in the whole panoply of savings and investing products available to US consumers is between 1/3 of 1% and 1/2 of 1%. That is, precious metals and precious metals related assets comprise less than 1/2 of 1% of total savings and investment assets in the United States. Grievously underowned. The three-decade mean is between 1.5% and 2%. So it doesn't have to win the war against the US dollar. It just needs to lose it less badly. If gold and precious metals market shares returned to the three-decade mean, demand for this asset class would somewhere between triple and quadruple, which is precisely what I think happens over the next 4 or 5 years. For those reasons, I don't think that what we see now is a recovery from an oversold bottom, but rather the beginnings of another secular bull market in gold and laterally precious metals equities.
That was, excuse me, a very, very good overview, Rick. And one of the things that you just said is gold is very undervalued. I think that's because a lot of people don't understand why they should hold gold in their portfolio. And I'd like to unpack that just a little bit by saying, you know, there are different ways of owning gold, from the physical to the royalty streaming to the gold equities. If you were to advise your clients at the moment, does one stand out from the others, or do you see that each have a role? And let's include ETFs in that as well. Not that I am an ETF fan.
Each has a role, to be sure. The bullion is really liquidity. It is, in my mind, a form of money. It's unique in that it's a financial liability, a financial asset that isn't simultaneously a liability. It's not a promise to pay its payment itself.
Yeah.
The Australian dollar, the US dollar are, in fact, floating abstractions. Doug Casey calls them IOU nothings. He calls the euro, by the way, a who owes you nothing, which I thought we But gold isn't that. It's not a promise to pay its payment itself. It's volatile liquidity, but it's good liquidity, particularly in times when the other forms of liquidity are being debased. Gold equities are different. There, you're buying fractional shares in a business. And the business does better as the price goes up, because as the gold price goes up, particularly in Australia, the gold price goes up faster than your costs go up. The idea that you produce gold in a country with a depreciating currency and you sell the gold in a country with a currency that's depreciating less rapidly is really, really, really beneficial. And it benefits even more with very, very low energy costs, because the energy inputs are important to the gold mining industry. So you buy gold mining shares because the net present value of the future cash flows at whatever gold price you choose to use feels cheap to you. If you buy gold shares for any reason other than that, you're likely making a mistake and don't know them, you know, don't know enough about them, ultimately not to be a victim yourself. But they're very different asset classes. I'm inclined to various categories of gold mining shares, although I must admit in my declining years, for many clients, I favor very, very high quality. And let me tell you why, Carrie. Never mind in the gold bull market, but in the recovery.
Sorry, Rick, let me just interrupt you there. When you say high quality, are you talking on the producer, developer, explorer, or quality is quality? Just producers?
The best of the best. The Francos, the Wheatons, the Barricks, the Newmonts, the Agnicos, the really high quality, high margin, liquid, great balance sheet producers. Now, ironically, a portfolio comprised of the best of the best will, over the course of a bull market, underperform the index. So people say, well, why would you deliberately underperform? Here's why. You don't have to do any work to own those shares. You de-risk the beta in the market. And in, never mind bull markets, but in 8 recoveries from oversold bottoms, the index itself increased in price between 100% and 700%. So let's say over 2 or 3 years, you only made 80% as 100%, or in a luckier case, you only made 400% as opposed to 500%. But you did it by de-risking the activity. For many people, that's a highly intelligent trade, de-risking the market to underperform beta. That isn't, of course, necessarily what I do for my own money, because I work very, very hard at it. A different set of circumstances, Kerry, is that this gold bull market originated, this one, in Australia. And the Australian market took off a long time before the US market and greatly outpaced the North American market. But now the North American market has caught up and surpassed it, which is a different way of saying there's better relative valuations in Australia than anywhere else in the world. For 2 reasons. It's a smaller capital market, not yet as internationalized, but also because there's a better mining culture in Australia. There's still a sense among some Australian managers that the value creation mechanism should be rocks to money. In Canada, it's become perverted. It's rocks to stocks and stocks to money.
Right.
And that middle part perverts the cycle. I believe that there is going to be, continue to be, a strong mergers and acquisitions market in the gold business. And I suspect that in Australia, if the valuations don't catch up, that is to say, if investors like myself don't come to Australia for relative valuations, that the multinational large cap producers will come to Australia in a mergers and acquisition mold. Sort of like you can pay me now or you can pay me later. Both of those are good. And so that's a sector that I see as being particularly attractive. And in further defense of that, Kerry, I know I don't necessarily have to make the gold case for Australians, but I'm going to make a different case. You know, Warren Buffett for years has, to be fair to him, made fun of gold. He described it as an inert substance that stared back at you when you stared at it, and a pet rock and all those things. All very amusing. And then, of course, one of his underlings probably bought $500 million worth of Barrick. Now, in fairness, $500 million for Buffett isn't even a rounding error. It's a comma. And I don't think it reflects any change in attitude with regards to gold. I think he still thinks it's a pet rock. But what it shows him is that he thinks that the gold mining companies as businesses are cheap. Because Mr. Buffett's valuation criterion is the net present value of future cash flows at today's product prices as a function of the enterprise value, which is market capitalization minus debt plus cash. In other words, Buffett is saying that gold miners are cheap, even though he doesn't like gold. And I think that's very, very profound.
Yeah, well, for Buffett, it's a business like any other business. And as he has said in the past, you look at a business and if it is undervalued, you buy it. You know, and it wouldn't surprise me if in a couple of years he's like, well, I'm done with that because it's now full value and moves on. Because I don't think he necessarily looks at it as gold per se. For him, it's a business.
I think he, you know, sort of clenched his teeth when he bought it. You know, because he doesn't like the product that they produce. But it does speak to the valuations of the free cash flow that the industry is generating at these gold prices, never mind the higher gold prices that I think are likely.
Rick, are you looking at Australian mining companies at the moment? I mean, you just spoke about Warren Buffett investing in Barrick. Actually, Barrick exited Australia not that long ago. Do you think that there's a possibility that they might be saying to themselves, whoops, maybe we need to go back into Australia? Because you mentioned mergers and acquisitions. Not a lot of that happening at the moment down here, but potentially you think that could be coming.
I think the only thing in Australia that Barrick would buy would be Newcrest. Barrick wants tier one deposits, deposits that are in the best quartile worldwide for return on capital employed and the lowest cost quartile worldwide. Would Barrick want Lihir as an example? You betcha. Would they come down the quality trail and rebuy the assets they bought? I don't think so. I think that Barrick looked at the opportunity set that they had in front of them, and they looked at the love, care, and attention that the Australian assets would have required. And I think Barrick rightly decided, I think this was very intelligent, I think they rightly decided that those assets should be in the hands of people who were closer to them and for whom they were more important. I think that what has happened with regards to the acquirers, the Northern Stars of the world, is precisely what Barrick thought would happen. I think these are fantastic transactions. I think they benefited the seller, and I think they benefited the buyer, and I think they benefited Australian society too. But there are companies that are lesser lights than Barrick, some Australian, some foreign, that will begin to consolidate the Australian sector if it doesn't become substantially more expensive.
Rick, we've been speaking about the mining companies. We briefly touched on royalty as well. For those people, and there are a lot, I recently held a virtual gold conference. We had close to 1,000 people register for that. The majority of them would be investors. And a lot of them came back to me asking questions of, you know, this is their first exposure to investing in gold. What would be, in a concise way, what would your recommendation be, especially for people that have never had exposure? Would you suggest that they buy a little bit of physical silver and gold, or would you suggest that they do their research and go into the mining companies, or take away a little bit of the, the risk and invest in a streaming company?
I don't think that there's a one-size-fits-all answer, Kerry.
Okay.
The harder an investor is willing to work, the more risk an investor can take in search of more reward. For some investors, for the people who are set in life but don't want to lose purchasing power, they should buy physical gold and silver. They should buy it and hope it doesn't go up in price, because the set of circumstances that makes it go up in price will make the rest of their life miserable. They should buy it as insurance. For other investors, participating in the beta to hedge the rest of their equity portfolio is a wise choice. And those investors should buy the best of the best, the big royalty and streaming companies, the Wheatons, the Francos, the big operating companies. For investors who can afford to be, or are by temperament more aggressive and willing to work harder, they should absolutely come down the scale. They should absolutely compete in arenas where the distribution of information is unequal, where they can work harder than other investors and enjoy the competitive advantage that comes from discovering information in a market where information is hard to come by. In the mining business, opinions are really easy to come by, But information, hard analysis, is much more difficult to come by. You can do it. And if you do it, you have sort of achieved 1 in 100 status, because the other 99 won't do it. They won't read the proxy. They won't read the annual report. They won't read the engineer's report. They won't read the research reports. All you have to do-
Well, they won't understand them. A lot of them won't understand it.
Pretty easy to understand. Well, for sure, if you don't read it, you won't understand it. I'll give it to you that. But some investors have no idea whether or not the companies they own are profitable, whether or not they earn their cost of capital, whether or not the management team owns any shares at all.
Yeah.
The truth is, to outcompete your fellow investors, all you really need to do is show up.
Very good advice. Now, listen, before we finish up, I've got a number of things I want to ask you, because I know that you've been following the poor old uranium sector. We've talked a lot about gold and precious metals, but I just want to do a quick overview of uranium. It's been the dog in the doghouse for a very long time, very unloved. But I believe you're looking at that at the moment, especially with the energy challenges coming forward globally. What's your views on uranium right now?
You might remember in 2011, Kerry, at your conference, my theme was, you are either a contrarian or you will be a victim.
Yeah.
And when you describe something as unloved, that's high praise indeed for me. But uranium is more than unloved. It's in fact hated. When I talk about uranium, investors describe me as a despicable human looking to profit off Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. They aren't really bored by it. They hate it, which lets me know I'm looking in the right place. As you suggest, it's in the doghouse, which is a different way of saying it's cheap.
Yeah.
And I like things that are cheap. Let's look at the arithmetic around uranium a little bit. The International Energy Agency suggests that the fully loaded cost to produce a pound of uranium, not just the mine site cost, but cost of capital, G&A, prior year write-downs, is somewhere between 50 and 60 US dollars a pound.
Yeah.
So you make the stuff for 50 bucks a pound, and you sell it for 30 bucks a pound. You lose 20 bucks a pound, and you do it about 90 million times a year. It's kind of boring. What that means is that sustaining capital isn't being spent, that production's being shut down, and new projects aren't being developed because people are losing too much money in their existing projects. It also means that uranium is very cheap. It offers high utility to consumers. In some circumstances, the operating 3% of the operating cost of a nuclear power plant is fuel costs. So if the price goes up, it doesn't change the price of the output of the electricity. Now, I just know the U.S. numbers, but in the U.S., uranium provides about 15% of total electric supply and about 20% of baseload electric supply. What that means, very simply, is that for the next 15 or 20 years, until we have a smart grid, redundant storage capacity, which is a fancy way of saying batteries, all kinds of distributed production, we have to have uranium, or else the lights go out. Specifically, in terms of arithmetic, in the next 5, 6, 7 years, if the price of uranium doesn't go up to the point where the producers are earning their cost of capital, the lights go out. Mm. Those are the two choices. It's very simple. So your listeners, when they think about uranium, have to ask themselves one simple question to begin with. Do I believe the price is going to go up, or do I believe the lights are going to go out? Once you've got past that question, then you think about uranium. Does it have to happen soon? No, it probably won't happen soon. The shutdown of the Japanese nuclear industry took probably 80 million pounds of inventory, which was held as fuel, and turned it into held as supply because it goes to supply plants that are shut down. So in the near term, the price of uranium is determined by the price of Japanese restarts. But the question as to a uranium price rise is a question where the answer necessarily begins with the word when, not if. And when questions are very, very, very good questions. The second thing that people should understand about the uranium business is that the narrative is strong, but the market capitalization of the sector is tiny. So when interest returns to the sector, there literally isn't enough market capitalization to hold the money. In the uranium bull market that occurred in the period 2000 to 2006, at the beginning of that period, there were 5 uranium juniors worldwide.
Wow.
The worst of them, the worst performer of them over 6 years, increased 22-1. The best, which was Paladin, an Australian listing, increased from, you're sitting down, $0.01 to $10.
That's right.
I repeat, $0.01 to $10. So that's the reward. The other thing that your speculative listeners need to pay attention to is they need to remember that there is a group of old, fat, fairly smart, rich investors, I'm one, who were there for the last bull market. And to say that we profited understates it in very, very, very dramatic terms. And we're all around and we'd all like one more shot at that. And what that means is that when the market begins to give us an excuse, the crowding in that you will see from high net worth and ultra high net worth investors who participated in it last time will be mind boggling. You know, Carrie, in the last bull market, the listings in the uranium space increased from 5 to 500.
Whoa.
comical because
that's
there were
crazy.
There were probably only 15 management teams that were competent to run a uranium company. So at the top, when uranium was profitable, you know, popular, the probability that your uranium company was well run was a function of dividing the number of teams, 15, by the number of aspirants, which is 500, which is a really shitty math. Now we have a circumstance where the number of aspirants worldwide has fallen from 500 to 20.
Wow.
And amazingly, of these 20, there are 7 or 8 that are really very high quality. When I look at the gold universe worldwide, there's probably 1,600 juniors. And I don't suspect that you could buy 150 of them with a straight face if you understood the companies, which is to say that less than 10% are investable, even for a veteran speculator like myself. In the uranium space, there's a universe of 20, and I think that 8 are investable.
So almost 50%, wow.
Despite the fact that it's out of favor, the group value in the space is, I think, very, very good. Now, in order for somebody to do this, they have to be patient, they have to be disciplined, they have to be willing to accept volatility, and amusingly, they have to relish hate. You know, it requires all.
But also, doesn't it come down to two things as well? Because what is going to be the catalyst to change this market? Because isn't it one, psychology, and two, governments want voters, and if it doesn't match the narrative of the voters saying we don't like uranium, it's never going to change.
Well, actually, it's sort of a false narrative in the sense that, as an example, Germany shut down their nuclear fleet.
Yep.
And so they've had to do two things. Well, three things, really. They've had to triple the price of electricity, which is not something that the voters are happy about. They've also had to begin to burn incredible amounts of dirty brown coal. And of course, they've imported large amounts of electricity generated by nuclear from France and Poland. So does the Watt care where it was generated? Politicians' job is to deceive, and they're good at it. It's really arithmetic. It's really the market share of nuclear worldwide in baseload. And the fact that there is no substitution for uranium in the time that is required to have a substitution. Could you get rid of uranium? Sure, but you'd have to invest trillions of dollars in a smart grid. If you're going to replace it with things like solar, well, you have a problem at night, of course, with solar. But all of these interruptible, distributable power sources means that you have to have system-wide redundancy. In other words, you have to have 170 or 180% generating capacity relative to normalized demand. And there's just no way in the world there's not enough money to do that in the next 20 years. But the shortfall in uranium supplies will occur in somewhere between 1.5 and 5 years. It's inescapable, literally inescapable. And you know what? It doesn't matter what Greta thinks. It doesn't matter what the politicians think. Even Miss Greta, when she walks into a room and hits the switch, wants the lights to go on.
Absolutely.
Failing.
Rick, I could talk to you for hours, but two things. First of all, what would be your final comments to the investors that are listening at the moment, some of whom are sitting back, fearful of taking any action, and some of whom are in the market, but potentially making not the best plays? What would be your summation of your views at the moment with the market?
First things first, be liquid. Don't be all in. Be liquid. It's true that your cash declines in purchasing power every year, but think of it as an option payment. If you have the cash, you'll have the tools and you'll have the courage, I hope, to take advantage of volatility rather than being taken advantage of. The second thing is to understand that the price of an investment is of no interest if you don't have an opinion as to value. It's the discrepancy between price and value that is where you make your money. So if you're not willing to do the work to determine value, you need to be extremely, extremely cautious with your money. Investment returns are a function of work and discipline. And the amount of risk that you're allowed to take prudently is really a function of your psychological reserves and your capacity to do intelligent work. I have a lot of clients who are very, very, very smart, who use me not because they need me, but they use me because they'd prefer to play with their grandchildren and fish and garden, as opposed to do securities analysis. They would prefer that I did the securities analysis. You are always your best investment advisor unless you aren't going to work, in which case you need one.
And that leads me very nicely on to how can people, first of all, how can people follow your views? How can they subscribe? And I believe you've got a special offer for those people listening today. But more importantly, you just said it. If people want to play with their grandchildren and not do the discipline, the hard work, how do they get Rick Rule's brain?
Well, I'm going to make it hopefully attractive for them. If your listeners and subscribers will go to a web link, SprotUSA.com. That's SprotUSA, all one word, .com/rankings. You'll find a web form there. And if you enter your natural resource portfolio's name and symbol, I personally will rank your portfolio 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst, and I'll comment on those companies where I think my comments might have value. In addition to that, I'm going to send two beautiful charts. The first is the Barron's Gold Mining Index. I use that index because it's the broadest index in the world and it's the longest running index in the world. I'm not a technical analyst, but this is a wonderful visual tool that will show you the performance of bull markets and bear markets, and show you in particular where we are today relative to markets over the last 50 years, and show you just exactly where the gold indexes could and I think will go. It's really truly dramatic. The chart will also show you the breathtaking cyclical declines that occur in secular bull markets. In American parlance, if you do this, you're going to a rodeo, and the chart will help you be prepared for the ride that you're going to endure.
Right.
The chart that I'll send is a 100-year commodity chart, which shows the valuations of the commodities complexes relative to other parts of the economy. And it will show you just how undervalued commodities are relative to the levels that they've been at over the last 100 years. I'm not suggesting that we're going to have a commodities bull market right away. But Carrie, I think when we do have a commodities bull market, it's going to be, in very rude American parlance, a rip-your-face-off rally. So in summary, we would like to talk to your listeners and subscribers. As an incentive, we'll send them these two wonderful, wonderfully educational charts, and I will personally rank their portfolios to the best of my ability. There's going to be some obscure Australian companies where I need to say no opinion because I have no opinion.
Well, that means we'll just have to get you to come out to Australia once the chaos has calmed down. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that is an amazing offer from Mr. Rick Rule himself. He is going to check out your portfolio. He's going to rank it. I'll put the link in the comments below. But to me, you don't get better than that. Now, some of you may turn around and go, I didn't want to hear that. But you need to hear it because Rick Rule has been in the resources securities business since the early 70s. He knows what he's talking about. And I think, Rick, that's an incredibly generous offer to our listeners out there. So, you know what? Be quick, because you never know. He might turn around and say, I've had enough of this. So be quick. Make sure you go to SprotUSA.com/rankings. Link will be down below. Rick Rule, as always, been an absolute pleasure listening to your views on where we are in the markets today on both gold and uranium. And I hope we speak to you again in the not too distant future. Thank you so much for joining us.
I look forward to it, Carrie. We haven't been together for too long.
I know. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.